Forsaken by the late folk singer Michael Hurley, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio a few years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is in Washington this week. On Monday, he met with President Trump and other officials at the White House for the third face-to-face meeting since Trump's new term. Ahead of dinner, Prime Minister Netanyahu told a reporter Israel and the U.S. are speaking to third countries about relocating Palestinians from Gaza. Netanyahu said it would give Palestinians free choice.
I think President Trump had a brilliant vision. It's called free choice. You know, if people want to stay, they can stay. But if they want to leave, they should be able to leave. It shouldn't be a, you know, a prison. It should be an open place and give people a free choice. We're working with the United States very closely about finding countries that will seek to realize what they always say, that they want to give the Palestinians a better future. And those who, and I think we're getting close to finding several countries, and I think this will do, again, the freedom to choose. Palestinians should have it. And I hope that we can secure it.
That's Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, saying Palestinians should have the freedom to choose. He wasn't talking about a two-state solution or a one-state solution. He was talking about leaving. Netanyahu also took the opportunity to announce he has nominated President Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize and presented him with a nominating letter. The audio is a little hard to hear, so listen carefully.
So I want to present to you, Mr. President, the letter I sent to the Nobel Prize Committee. It's not a new year for the Peace Prize, which is well deserved, and you should get it.
Thank you very much. This I didn't know.
That was Prime Minister Netanyahu presenting President Trump with a letter he sent to the Nobel Prize Committee nominating him for the Peace Prize. Hopes around the world are high. A ceasefire in Gaza could come out of this week's talks. Outside the White House, though, demonstrators gathered to protest the visit of Netanyahu, who has been accused of war crimes by the International Criminal Court, as well as U.S. support for the war in Gaza.
No justice, no peace.
The fact that people are suffering and being killed the way they are, it's unbelievable that this is happening in this day and age, and I feel helpless, and I feel like our country is hijacked by people who want this to continue and are making it possible, and that's not what I want my tax dollars to go to.
To discuss U.S.-Israel relations and more, we're joined by Peter Beinart. He is an editor-at-large at Jewish Currents, his most recent book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. He's also a professor at the Newmark School of Journalism at the City University of New York. His new opinion piece for the New York Times is headlined, Democrats Need to Understand That Opinions on Israel Are Changing Fast. He joins us here in our New York studio. So first, Peter, if you can start off by responding to this third little summit in Washington between Trump and Netanyahu, where Trump is saying that with the negotiators in Doha, Hamas and Israel, and his meetings with Netanyahu, that they are close to a 60-day ceasefire, what this means, and Netanyahu talking about finding the third country where they will relocate Palestinians to, that and assuring people that they have freedom to choose.
Right, this phrase freedom to choose is so Orwellian. First of all, what kind of freedom is it when you have a territory where most of the buildings and the hospitals and the schools and the bakeries and the agriculture have all been destroyed, where you have more child amputees than any other place on earth, and now you're talking about people's freedom to choose? The deeper irony is that Palestinians have actually been in Gaza and beyond have been asking for the freedom to choose, the real freedom to choose, since 1948, because the vast majority of Palestinians in Gaza are not from Gaza. They were expelled from their homes in what's now Israel. Many of them can see the lands from which their families were expelled in 1948. So they do want the freedom to choose. They want the freedom to return to the places from which their families were expelled. But that's, of course, not the freedom they're being offered. The freedom they're being offered is to be made refugees again because Gaza has been utterly destroyed, to go to some other place around the world so Israel can continue this process of ethnic cleansing.
And Peter, the fact that here we see Netanyahu for the third time this week coming to the United States, the idea that even Democrats would meet with a leader who the International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for, your reaction?
It is really remarkable. I mean, the line from the Biden administration was that the Democratic Party believed in the rules-based international order. The United States actually worked with the International Criminal Court on the indictment of Vladimir Putin. So here you have Benjamin Netanyahu having been indicted by the International Criminal Court. Even some of America's partners in Europe have said that because they believe in international law, they would carry out that arrest warrant. In the United States, instead, Netanyahu is celebrated in a largely bipartisan way, including by Democrats, even though the man has been indicted as a war criminal by the International Criminal Court. What does it say about the Democratic Party's stated belief in the rules-based international order and human rights that they would do such a thing?
And could you talk about the growing opposition to Netanyahu's government within Israel, and many believing that he's continuing these armed conflicts precisely to prevent his day of reckoning in the Israeli courts and among the Israeli people?
Well, I think something may have changed here now. I think it is widely believed in Israel that he was continuing this assault on Gaza because if it ended, it would be clear that Israel had not achieved its goals. It had not destroyed Hamas, and then his government would fall apart and he would go to elections, which many thought he would lose. I think what has shifted is since Israel's bombing of Lebanon and Syria and Iran, Netanyahu's popularity has increased. He may now believe that he can agree to a ceasefire, even though it will be clear that the war has failed, that Hamas is not actually destroyed and defeated. But what he did in Iran and Lebanon and Syria is popular, that he may be able to go to an election and think he can win. That, I think, is the reason that there could be a ceasefire now.
Peter, you did a guest essay for the New York Times. It's headlined, "Democrats Need to Understand That Opinions on Israel Are Changing Fast." And the image that accompanies the essay is a photograph of Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic candidate for mayor of New York. If elected, he would be the first South Asian and Muslim mayor of New York City. He calls himself a Democratic socialist, was a former state assemblyman. I want to ask you about Zohran Mamdani, and particularly coverage in the New York Times. We'll get to that coverage in a minute, who they wrote a piece against him when they said they weren't going to endorse anyone in the Democratic primary, and then have written another piece. But I first want to talk about the significance of his win and how it is tied to that changing opinion on Israel around the country, why it's, sent shockwaves through the Democratic Party throughout the United States.
Right. I think one of the reasons people thought Mamdani couldn't win was they had a set of assumptions about what was politically possible on the question of Israel-Palestine that are just really out of date if you look at public opinion. I'm not sure there's any political issue in the United States, perhaps other than gay marriage, over the last couple of decades where public opinion has shifted as fast as it is shifting on Israel-Palestine. Just to give an example, in 2013, Democrats favored Israel over the Palestinians by 36 points. Today, they favor the Palestinians over Israel by 38 points. Even young Republicans, even Republicans under the age of 50, now a majority of them have a negative view of Israel. So what Mamdani is doing is revealing a dramatic shift that's taking place, being led by young people, but not only among young people, that's happening in New York and across the country. My article, what I was suggesting in the Times is Democrats running for president in 2028 should look at what has happened with Mamdani, because he has revealed that the politics on Israel in the Democratic Party and beyond have radically shifted in terms of public opinion.
And let me ask you about the Times coverage and what exactly they are doing. I wanted to go to a piece that Margaret Sullivan wrote. She used to be the public editor of the New York Times. It's been widely criticized, the Times, because it has relied on widespread information that was hacked on Columbia University databases. The information reached the New York Times through an intermediary who the Times didn't identify, but it was later revealed to be Jordan Lasker, a well-known eugenicist and criticized white supremacist. The former public editor of the Times, who I was talking about, known as the ombudsman, Margaret Sullivan, called the decision to publish the piece based on stolen information unwise, and that it fell far short of the newsworthiness bar. During the primary, the paper officially doesn't make endorsements. They publish an editorial urging voters not to even rank Mamdani in New York's ranked choice voting system. Sullivan writes, quote, "The incident raises a larger issue, the Times' apparent opposition to Mamdani's candidacy." She writes, quote, "The opinion side of the Times is entitled to its opinion, however misguided. But straight news articles, by contrast, aren't supposed to go to bat for or against candidates. With this made-up scandal combined with the pre-election editorial, the Times looks like it's on a crusade against Mamdani." And she was also referring to the fact that the documents that were gotten from a Columbia database show that when Zoran Mamdani applied as an 18-year-old to college, he applied to Columbia, he wasn't accepted, but he checked the box African-American, among others, also South Asian, and under it wrote Ugandan, where he was born, where his family, his father's family, had lived for 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really important to understand about Zoran Mamdani and about his father, who's a very, very distinguished political scientist, Mahmoud Mamdani, is that their identity was as Africans, right? And that the vision they had of Uganda was of a country that was multiracial, an African country that was multiracial, that included people like their families who came from South Asia, and people who were black. In fact, in some ways, this was the struggle against Idi Amin. I mean, not to get into the weeds here, but Idi Amin had expelled Asians from Uganda precisely because of his racist view that South Asians were not truly Africans. And so for Zoran Mamdani, it was an important statement to say, I am an African. Now, this is actually important. My family are South Africans, right? Obviously, my family are South Africans, Jews who came to South Africa. But it was very important for many of those Jews to say that we are also part of this country. And I think when you see when you understand it in that context, it's not the case that Zoran Mamdani was trying to pull some sleight of hand to try to take advantage of affirmative action. This was a very deep statement about what he believed it was to have grown up in Uganda. And I think that's what's perhaps not really understood about the context of this story.
Peter, going back to this, the race for mayor in New York, there are news reports now that the financial elite of New York are trying to convince all other candidates to eventually drop out behind one, whether that's Cuomo or Eric Adams, and even convincing Curtis Sliwa, the Republican, to drop out. They're trying to make a pact to all unite against Mamdani. I can't remember anything like that happening. You'd have to go back to 1950 when Vito Marcantonio was the East Harlem congressman, and the Democratic, the Republican Party, the Liberal Party all united to behind one candidate to defeat Marcantonio, who was the American Labor Party candidate and a socialist. Wondering your thoughts about this incredible attempt at an unholy alliance.
Well, in many ways, it kind of illustrates Mamdani's whole point, right? Which is that this is a city that is not working, that is really unaffordable for so many working class New Yorkers. But it's a city that in some ways is politically only working and so many ways controlled by people who have vast amounts of wealth. And, you know, if people have vast amounts of wealth, fine. But they should think about the people who live in their city who don't live in multi-million dollar apartments and go off to houses in the Hamptons and have a little bit of empathy and concern for the fact that there's so many New Yorkers who would really benefit from having free buses or not having to pay so much for rent. Like, have some human concern and empathy. These people don't care at all about that. All they care about is making sure that they don't have to pay a little bit more in taxes, even though they would not even notice it given the scale of their wealth. And they're threatened by Zoran Mamdani's support for the idea of equality between Israeli Jews and Palestinians, right? It's extraordinary that they would be so afraid and so angry at a man who is simply talking about the basic idea that Israeli Jews and Palestinians deserve to be treated equally, which I thought was the principle that we were supposed to believe in the United States.
I want to thank you so much, Peter, for joining us. Peter Beinart, editor-at-large at Jewish Currents. His most recent book is Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. He's also a professor at the Newmark School of Journalism at the City University of New York. And we'll link to your opinion piece in the New York Times. Democrats need to understand that opinions on Israel are changing fast. Next up, we speak with Professor John Bellamy Foster on the Trump Doctrine and the new MAGA imperialism. Back in 20 seconds.
It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight, I want heaven. Hey, with you. It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight, I want heaven. Hey, with you.
It was 11:59 and 59 clicks. The whole world's burning, but the clock just ticks over and over every single day. Some people steal while other people pray to God, to man, machines, or whatever. Some of us just lost faith altogether. No way, they say, we can't live this way. That's why so many people stand up and say, one love, one blood, one heart, one soul and one drum and only one rhythm, one tribe and all of us singing. It's 11:59 and 59 seconds.
Michael Franti in our Democracy Now! Studios a decade ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Trump announced on social media Monday a new round of threatened tariffs ranging from 25 to 40% on imports from 14 countries, including Bangladesh, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, Thailand, set to take effect August 1st, barring new deals. Meanwhile, Trump has threatened to impose an additional 10% tariff on countries that align themselves with the BRICS group of nations, led by Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Trump cited the group's, quote, anti-American policies. The threat came as Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva kicked off a two-day BRICS summit in Rio de Janeiro.
So we don't want an emperor. Our countries are sovereign. If Trump issues tariffs, other countries have the right to do the same. There is the reciprocity law. I think it's not responsible for a president from a country like the United States to threaten the world with tariffs on social media. Honestly, there are other forums for the president of a country the size of the United States to talk to other countries.
This comes as Vice President J.D. Vance has been promoting Trump's new foreign policy approach. Vance addressed the Ohio Republican Party last month.
What I call the Trump doctrine is quite simple. Number one, you articulate a clear American interest, and that's, in this case, that Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. Number two, you try to aggressively, diplomatically solve that problem. And number three, when you can't solve it diplomatically, you use overwhelming military power to solve it, and then you get the hell out of there before it ever becomes a protracted conflict.
For more, we're joined by John Bellamy Foster, professor of sociology at University of Oregon, editor of the Monthly Review, where his new article is headlined, The Trump Doctrine and the New MAGA Imperialism. Well, why don't you lay out your thesis for us, Professor John Bellamy Foster, and welcome to Democracy Now.
Well, thank you. The Trump Doctrine was articulated in the first Trump administration. Normally, the presidential doctrines are determined by the press, who see the administrations operating in a certain way according to a certain principle, and they designate that as a doctrine. The Trump administration has been different. There was a lot of confusion about Trump foreign policy. Was it isolationist? Was it anti-imperialist? In the first Trump administration, Michael Anton, who was one of the main MAGA ideologues and came from the Claremont Institute, which is one of the primary MAGA institutions, was in the National Security Council, and they basically had him leave the National Security Council in order to formally articulate a Trump doctrine that the media would take seriously and foreign policy experts would take seriously. So he gave a lecture. He was appointed at Hillsdale College, which is a MAGA institution, and he gave a lecture at Princeton University where he articulated the Trump doctrine, and then that was published in Foreign Policy, the leading foreign policy journal in the United States. And the Trump doctrine is said, and now Michael Anton is the deputy, he's the director of policy planning for the State Department. So he's the main idea man, essentially Assistant Secretary of State. He's the main idea man in the State Department. And he articulated on behalf of Trump a doctrine, a Trump doctrine with four pillars. The first one was national populism, which is the way in which the MAGA movement designates itself. It's sort of a neo-fascist designation. It resonates with the national socialism of the Nazi movement. But national populism is the first pillar. The second pillar is that all nations should be primarily nationalistic in their orientation. The third one is the opposition to liberal internationalism and to the liberal hegemony of the United States over the world order that was established after the Second World War and is continued to this day. Instead, what is defined is a hyper-nationalist America First imperium, where the United States essentially rules the world on its own. But the fourth pillar is the most important. And Anton went back to Aristotle, who said there were three forms of political organization: the tribe or ethnicity, the city-state or state, and the empire. And empires are defined as multi-ethnic. And the Trump doctrine is opposed to multi-ethnic empires and multi-ethnic nations, and argues that we should determine our foreign policy by ethnicity and essentially the tribe. In fact, it's a racial definition of foreign policy with the notion that the United States is a white country and other ethnicities don't belong, and we're going to organize our foreign policy as well as our domestic policy on that basis. So the Trump doctrine was very important. Remember, Anton is now the number one policymaker within the State Department. So this is not a secondary matter.
Professor, I wanted to ask you, in your analysis, which is I found to be among the clearest I've seen anywhere about this this new fascist movement, you contradict the perspective of a lot of people that the Trump neo-fascism has a working class base. In fact, you say that there were three sectors of the monopoly capitalist class, the tech sector, the oil and gas sector, and private equity sector, that have basically united with the lower middle class, a huge portion of the lower middle class and privileged workers who formed the base of the MAGA movement. Could you talk about that a little more?
Well, sociologically, we often talk about the lower middle class, which is a very clear political cultural designation in U.S. society. These are small property owners, small landowners, lower level managers within corporations, rural populations. The evangelical movement is tied to this. And the population within the lower middle class is predominantly white and is above the, in terms of income and property ownership is well above the working class, which we could say is the bottom 60% of the population. And the lower middle class also votes much more heavily than the working class. So this has actually been Trump's political base. The lower middle class is very nationalistic, a tendency to be nationalistic, what we call revanchist, that is arguing that we have to return to an earlier age, make America great again. They tend to be very racist and anti-immigrant, misogynist, very patriarchal in their orientations. So the populations of the lower middle class are very heavily located in the exurbs. So this is the base, the sociological base and political base of Trump. And as soon as Trump phenomena came into being, the New York Times, which hadn't talked about the working class for decades, started to refer to the white working class. But really, it's about the lower middle class. And the lower middle class is traditionally they used to be called the petty bourgeoisie, is traditionally the base for all movements in the fascist genus. If you go back to the 1930s to Italy and Germany, it's the same constituency that drove the fascist movement. But it's a result of an alliance between big capital for the billionaires, monopoly finance capital, at the very top of the society and the lower middle class. The lower middle class is not anti-capitalist. They're basically opposed to what they see are what in the MAGA ideology is called the ruling class, mm-hmm. which is the professional managerial class, which is seen as controlling government. And they're also opposed to the working class, which they see as multi-ethnic and diverse and poverty-stricken and a population that they don't want to fall into. So the lower middle class is sort of the rear guard of the system. The billionaires have basically mobilized them, beginning with the Tea Party and then the Trump phenomenon, to turn the entire political system to the hard right, turn to developing a neo-fascist movement of this kind, which has, of course, all sorts of contradictions.
John Bellamy Foster, we want to thank you so much for being with us, professor of sociology at the University of Oregon, editor of the Monthly Review, speaking to us from Washington State. His most recent piece, we'll link to at democracynow.org, called The Trump Doctrine and the New MAGA Imperialism. Happy birthday to Christine Marr. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hey, are you okay? It's okay not to be okay. That's why Kids Help Phone is available 24/7, 365 days a year across Canada. So you don't have to deal with your feelings alone. You can text with a trained volunteer crisis responder or call a professional counselor, whatever works best for you. You can also connect with Kids Help Phone through trained interpreters in over 100 languages, and it's always free. Visit kidshelpphone.ca for more info and give your feelings a place to go.